Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This morning I've decided that we need some clarity on why we're not getting any load shedding. And I mean, we know the election's coming up, but still, you know, this is a lot of no load shedding to have. So I thought I'd dragoon my colleague from the Centre for Risk Analysis, Chris Hutton, who has been on before and will elucidate on the mysteries of why are we having no load shedding. Chris.
It is a bit of a mystery. I think to try and play devil's advocate, to try and give credit maybe where it's due, we'll only see usually with Eskom and their data and their system status reports, which are publicly available. So anyone can go onto their website, and I recommend that you do so at least to prevent yourself from getting a heart attack, because you can see how much red there is in the coming weeks and months based on Eskom's own projections. But you can interrogate the data for yourself, which isn't always the case with government and state-owned entities. So it's something. So if you go and look at those system status reports, I think there's two elements at play. There's more planned maintenance, and that means Eskom ahead of time takes some of its coal generation fleets, the coal power stations, they take that offline so that they can do refurbishment, do equipment replacements, maintenance, as one should. I mean, if you take your car in, hopefully at least once a year, if your car is new, if it's older, maybe more than that. But if you are proactive with your maintenance, that means you're not going to prevent all breakdowns, but you're going to be somewhat proactive and then manage that somewhat adequately. So one can see based on the reports, there's an element now of more planned maintenance. That does mean that more of the fleet is unavailable. So the operating margin or operating reserve, as Eskom calls it, is quite small. In some weeks, it's between 1,000 to 2,000 megawatts, sometimes around 1,500. So between that 1,000 and 2,000, that's quite small. And you're operating a bit on the edge, as it were, because if you've got a massive upsurge in demand, or if you're parts of your fleet that you didn't take offline for maintenance then break down, that operating reserve or margin gets wiped out, and then you're back at stage 5, 6, et cetera. So it doesn't give you that padding, as it were. So I'm seeing at the moment the planned maintenance a bit higher and Eskom trying to benefit from that over the long term. But I think they're also benefiting from some of that planned maintenance that was done under former CEO Andre de Reiter, where there's priorities around some of the older stations, which should be upgraded and maintained, but those are the best performing ones, as opposed to the new ones like Kusile and Medupi, where one of those, there at least three units are now active, but they haven't been synced to the grid yet. So there's a whole bunch of things going on in the background. The biggest thing for me at the moment is the maintenance. I'm not going to rule out that things like using lots of diesel reserves is still ongoing, using the open cycle gas turbines. Those numbers we will see in time if Eskom uses all of its diesel budget, et cetera, or if we go back to higher stage of load shedding because those open cycle gas turbines have broken down. Those aren't designed to be run 24/7, but I think given the 29th of May, I think there's strong incentive to use whatever resources you have, even if you're straining some of your equipment like you shouldn't.
Is the fact that there's been a reduction, a dramatic reduction in unplanned maintenance, which is what happens when things suddenly go wrong and you have to fix them, is that a matter of luck, or do you have a sense that Eskom has, by sort of getting a little more on top of the planned maintenance, the unplanned stuff is not happening? So is it luck or design?
I'm trying to figure it out. And one way to try and figure that out is to try and get as much data from each power station as possible. So to go and see which ones are the core sort of pillars of the fleet. So stations like Tutuka, for example, to go and see how is their output looking. And some of them are better than they have been in the past. So if one goes and looks at entities like News24, Daily Maverick, now and then they'll publish these investigations where they share photos journalists have tried to go and take, you know, actual pictures of the power stations to see basic things like dust gathering, you know, your basic housework, if you want to put it that way, that you should do. Yes. And if that happens in your own home, if your appliances then break because they're covered in dust, et cetera, you shouldn't be surprised. So I think there has been an element of trying to be proactive with those core power stations. But on the other hand, I think there is luck as well. And mostly that is, and it's not as though the economy is booming and it's at 10% and everyone's got money. But the luck is due to the private sector bringing on private sector generation. So solar, things like that. Solar, of course, isn't readily dispatchable. So you can't use it to run mining, your mine shafts and all that sort of thing, heavy industry, your iron ore smelters for ArcelorMittal and entities like that, which are also under pressure for other reasons, including labor issues. So that has taken pressure off Eskom, where they can now focus on some of their maintenance. I don't know if they're still being as proactive as they should be. They're really trying to catch up for years of neglect across the board. But I think it's a combo of trying to identify core stations that can be improved, and then also being lucky by being saved by private sector investment in things like solar, which on sunny days and throughout the summer, it has been a particularly hot, very sunny summer in South Africa. You benefit from that breathing room that solar has offered you.
I recall reading somewhere that suburban solar now fulfills the role of one or slightly more than one unit at a power station like Kusile or Medupe. So presumably, if that's so, what's happening is that power is being saved because less is being demanded of Eskom, certainly in the suburban sense. But as I understand, the excess power, and I know households do produce excess power, but we can't in Joburg feed back onto the grid. They're starting to do it in Cape Town, but we can't do it here. What is your sense that we can do it if they got it right, or is it there too much engineering required to actually get solar onto the grid? I know, for example, in Northern Cape, the big problem is you've got lots of solar, but your grid is pretty much inaccessible. So
yeah, I think
to provide a potential solution back into the sort of power provision.
I think it depends what you can do with your transmission grid. So South Africa has a lot of well-built-up transmission grid. It hasn't been maintained like it should have been, but the infrastructure is there. But then the issue with solar is how do you deal with the ups and downs in the amount that is available? And when you feed that back into the grid, how can that be controlled or moderated? So we know part of the reforms and all the grand compacts and all that sort of stuff is the spinning off of the different divisions of Eskom. So you've got generation, distribution, transmission, all sorts of other many. I think it's only three, at least ostensibly it's three, but it's probably going to be three more than that. So your transmission, there'll probably need to be quite a bit of upgrading, and especially in the sense of things like digitization systems. Can you control when whatever is fed back into the grid? And I'm no expert here, so I defer to people like Andrew Kenny, I think is worth reading his analysis on this sort of stuff. Ivo Fechter as well, over at the Daily Friend, where you can't have that fluctuation in terms of your energy, your current, and your supply. That's I think it's a big reason why something like coal is just so reliable, because it's always at a consistent level, except, of course, when it gets wet.
Of course, which fortunately, I must say, to my surprise or credit to you, that one hasn't appeared to have had much in the way of wet coal late, whether it's because we had a drought for 3 months or whether it was because they actually made sure their coal doesn't get wet. I'm not entirely sure. As you say, it's just sort of in the realm of the speculative. I think also, I mean, the problem I think for South Africa in trying to look at and be persuaded by the West that renewables is the answer is the problem that renewables would have anywhere in the world, and that is storage. You can't store the energy. You know, you've got to use the energy when it comes, and therein lies the problem. And do we run the risk of hitting that point where, because the demand is decreasing because alternative arrangements are being made, and while that leaves more essentially to Eskom to distribute elsewhere, you actually need increasing demand for the economy to grow. And so what you're not actually tackling in any real sense is the fact that to grow the economy, you actually do need to be able to provide a recent level of demand. And among the myriad of problems we have growing our economy, that conundrum is one of them.
No, 100%. I completely agree with that. I think if you don't have that cheap, reliable electricity supply, you can't run your heavy industry. I mean, talk about things like manufacturing. Our Minister for Trade, Industry and Competition loves talking about local manufacturing, localization, those grand plans, the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. If you don't have reliable electricity supply in your country, you're not going to have that level of manufacturing. So you're going to import more, you're going to lose jobs in things like manufacturing, mining. I mean, mining remains one of the biggest sectors of the economy, but not, I think, as much as it should be doing. In terms of the renewables and that supply, one hopes that the technology gets there at some point, but it's not where things like coal and nuclear are. And again, deferring to people like Andrew Kenny and Ivo Fechter, the cost per unit produced is higher for things like renewables. It is coming down in different places around the world, but not as fast as I think some advocates want it to be. And also not for a country like South Africa, where you just need abundant, cheap supply that takes advantage of our current generation and distribution and transmission setup. That doesn't mean you can't shift, but I don't think there should be any expectation or pressure that you can do that overnight, because you're going to impose, in my view, things like strong subsidies for renewables. You're going to prop up industries and players, manufacturers that aren't competitive because you quote unquote want to shift to that, but it's not based from an economic point of view. And I know we can't always reduce everything to ones and zeros and all that sort of thing. And if the line goes up, then everything is good. But broadly, you want your cost per unit of energy produced to be as cheap as possible. Mm. That is not to say that you can't shift to other forms over time. I mean, something like nuclear, you wish we'd built a few more stations longer ago, because if we start now, it's going to take how many years to get that sort of thing online. But I don't think the renewables should be, you should assume that solves your manufacturing and production issues. It can give people relief. It can help ESCOM, give them breathing room, but it's not what you need for a developing economy. If you look at some of our emerging market peers, Brazil, India, I mean, China, their growth is lagging. If you still consider them developing, their growth is lagging over the last 2 to 3 years due to their very strict COVID lockdowns. Those other countries, I think they're focusing on where can they get the most from their fossil fuel resources that they have. And I think credit to them.
Wondering whether, and I want to take you off topic and completely surprise you with this one, but I saw that, talking of problems, you know, which everything is connected to everything else, so let's go to the railways. If I remember correctly, I saw a comment, I think it was by Maersk, that they were not happy with the Filipino company that is meant to take over the running of Durban Harbour. Can you just give us a sort of bit of background on that? Who the Filipino company is and what Maersk's problem is with them?
So I might get the acronym wrong, but it's ICTSI, and the company is based in the Philippines. They do run parts or indeed whole ports in other parts of the world, including, I think, in Latin America. So they've got this track record. The bidding process to run specifically Pier 2 of Durban Harbour. So that's taken a while. And then in towards last year, the end of last year, this company ICTSI was selected. And then last month or so, Maersk has come to take the whole process to court. It was supposed to be the whole agreement was supposed to be signed by April between Transnet Ports Authority and ICTSI. That might only now be in May or June. It's also still subject to the approval of the union. So that's a whole nother, I think, kettle of fish to try and figure out for Transnet Ports Authority. But for now, Maersk, I'm guessing some of their concerns are around the bidding process, the competitiveness, some of the terms, all that sort of thing. So it looks like it's going to be a drawn out process. And at the end of the day, I mean, Pier 2 at Durban Port, and I'm speaking in a correction, but it's responsible for something like 46% of South Africa's exports. So it's vital for the country that Durban performs well. I mean, for things like automobiles, those jump immediately to mind. If anyone has driven between Joburg and Durban in the last 2 to 3 years, the amount of trucks with buckies and all that sort of thing, it's quite remarkable. But I think for now, Maersk is going to try and prevent this where sort of within the tools that are available to them. Of course, they want the contract. I'm not saying it's for altruistic reasons or anything like that. But you wonder you wonder what's behind it. And again, when it comes to South African SOEs, preferential procurement, cater deployment, you know, fairly or unfairly, the burden of proof has not been shifted from things like state capture. To think that state capture is over now, is not continuing in different ways, I think would be naive. So the concern is, you know, is there legitimacy behind what Maersk is doing? Why was this company from the Philippines chosen? Transnet now has a new CEO. There are good noises from entities like BLSA around what she's doing for Transnet as a whole. But for things like Transnet Ports Authority, Transnet Rail, you wonder still what is happening in the background.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the assumption that there are no quick fixes, you can destroy pretty quickly, but rebuilding is another issue. Essentially, I think, and it's interested in your comment on this, we're in a situation actually where there is actually, whatever the ANC is trying to do to improve things, there is a sort of stasis. And you can't make the radical changes that need to happen, which is government getting out of the way, bidding processes happening properly and fairly expeditiously at the same time, minimizing the corruption. You actually have to change who's in government to achieve that, or hopefully who's in government to achieve that. Because the whole ideological mindset, as particularly demonstrated in the figure of our Minister of Trade, et cetera, shows that the requirement to let go is too great for ANC to meet that need to the extent that the South African economy needs it.
Absolutely. Again, if you look at things like the appointment of cadres, if you look at SOEs, government departments, I mean, some private companies where deployees were placed to ensure that either for ideological reasons or just for pure sort of self-enrichment, that those relationships are win-win, but they're not necessarily the best appointments or decisions made for those SOEs or indeed for the economy as a whole. If you've got things like preferential procurement, where you insert these, to quote the former CEO of Eskom, André de Ruyter, you've got these non-value-adding intermediaries, then you increase the cost of things across the board. Of course, those entities can't function well. So to think if we just appoint a new CEO or someone, not to say that Michelle Phillips at Transnet isn't trying to do good work, but there's just so much underneath that and within the various SOEs and around them. One would think you require some sort of cleaning across the board. And I'm not sure, how long that'll take, probably quite a long time, but one shouldn't, even then, if you think your best case scenario is some form of multi-party charter winning 70% majority after the election, they can, do what they want. I think it's going to be very difficult to change those workforces, the public sector, change incentives, behavior, ways of viewing the relationship between government and the private sector and society. Yeah. Don't expect that. I'm not saying you can't start the process, but don't expect it to be solved immediately overnight. It's just become so entrenched, I think.
I think one of the problems, I think Helen Ziller said it in relation to the change in the city of Cape Town when the DA took over, is of all the things to manage, and there was lots to manage, the expectation of our expectations were the most difficult to manage because I suppose essentially people are so desperate. Just one last question. This is completely left field. There was a report that Cyril Ramaphosa says he does not regret rescinding the length of Jacob Zuma's prison sentence. For 64,000 points, is he lying?
I think it's trying to play as many people as possible and as many interests and constituencies as possible. I definitely think there's regret around that, but you have to try and save some sort of face before an election. That is this important. And I mean, if the polling is to be believed, then always take any polling by anyone with a pinch of salt. It's a snapshot of a given point in time. It's not a prediction of an election result. But if you've got MK polling at 25% in KZN, possibly as high as 10%, 15% nationally, I mean, what the ANC and President Ramaphosa did to make this whole thing possible is really coming back to bite them. But you have to try and save face. Almost the way with which he said it, you can try and read into sort of body language. I'm not sure if there's much belief in it, but you have to try and say the right things, as it were, to try and save some sort of face. So there's, I don't think there's anything there of, oh, we were trying to do quote unquote the right thing, or, you know, playing principles and morality. We haven't seen that in their actions in many areas, like everything we've pretty much talked about during today's discussion, to think that, oh, this time they bucked the trend and this time it was for doing the right thing and I'm moral and principled and whatever. I think it's trying to play many different groups and to try and save some element of face. But as has become the case with President Ramaphosa's presidency, this thing of trying to placate everyone, to try and speak to different audiences, eventually it shows him up, and it shows up in his cabinet as well. If you try and please everyone, even if that's assuming that's your only intention, you end up pleasing no one.
Of course. And I think what probably surprised Cyril himself more than anything is that he has been such a disappointment in the last 5 years that I think the vast majority of people would not trust anything he had to say to be the truth anymore. Chris, thank you very much for joining me. And, whenever we talk about power, I think we end up with more heat than light, figuratively and literally. So thank you once again, and we'll see you, talk to you soon.
Thank you.